It's time for Rose Chat on Blog Talk Radio. We're the only show on the airwaves dedicated to growing roses. We're glad you've joined us today. Our phone lines are open, and we'd love to hear from you during today's show. The number to call is 347-677-1870, or send us a tweet using the Rose Chat hashtag on Twitter. Join us as we explore the world of roses.
Well, if you're growing Yabba Dabba Doo, Sugar Moon, or Ketchup and Mustard, then you have a little bit of the rose-creating genius of Christian Bedard in your very own garden. Christian's the chief hybridizer at Weeks Roses, and he joins us now from sunny Southern California. Good morning, Christian. Welcome to Rose Chat.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're so glad you joined us today. Now, I know our listeners would like to know a little bit more about how roses are created at Weeks. Can you give us a little bit of insight about your hybridization program there?
Well, that's something most people don't realize. The whole process takes about 10 years.
Wow.
So we start putting the crosses together on paper during the winter. I have nothing else to do winter time, so we have to keep our mind busy about crosses. Then when the plant is put together, the pollination happens between April to the end of June of that year, which is basically pollination. I mean, taking the male part from one flower and crossing it with a female part of another flower. So, which is the anthers. So if everything goes well, you're going to have some hips, which are the little rounded fruit that you have when the flowers are spent, and those hips can seed. So normally about the end of August, those hips are starting to turn orange from the pollination that's being made in April, May, and June. And when they are fully orange, then we harvest them. Everything has to be harvested by family. And what I mean by family is we keep track of the mom and the dad of the seeds. So they are basically the parents of that seed that will turn into a seedling later. So we create bags with the mom and the dad, and we put the hips in the bag, like I said, the end of August all the way to about mid-September when the whole process is finished. Then, I'm going to explain it, but also you could go on the Weeks website. There's a section, How We Create Roses, and there's a slideshow with pictures, so it's probably easier for people to see it. Because the next step I was going to say is we put the hips in a blender, and I know it might sound weird a little bit, but we have water in the blender, and we dull the blade a little bit just so they could extract the seed from the hips without really damaging the seed. So it comes a slurry, and we go through a different size of screen, and all the debris from the hips actually will go through the screen, and the seed will stay on top. And then we harvest, collect those seeds from the screen, put them in moist paper towel, put them in cold storage, which is creating an artificial stratification for about 8 weeks. Then, we're already now, remember, we start the process in March, putting the crosses together on paper. So when everything is done, we're already, at this point, we're already mid-October about. Hmm. So the seeds will go in the cold storage for, like I said, about 8 weeks. And then we start planting right after Christmas. It's not too long that those little baby will come up. And we call them our rose baby because we're the father and, I guess, we're the creator, the daddy, or whatever you want to call us.
Right.
So then they come up real fast, sometimes within a couple of days. Sometimes some of them are already germinating in the refrigerator. So we just take them out, plant them, and to give you an idea how many we are producing is, on average, we will – have about 45,000 flower that we will pollinate.
Wow. 45,000?
Yeah, and this year we're already at 45,000. We're June the 8th, so we're going to be probably 52, 55 this year, which is a lot of flowers. If you think one by one, those flowers are emasculated, which means with a knife, we remove the anthers. We remove some of the petals to kind of expose the center, which is the female part. And then the next day we'll come with the paintbrush. The anther will dry, and with the paintbrush we'll collect the anthers, the pollen, and we will pollinate the style of a different flower that we want to pollinate with. So one by one, those flowers, those 45, 50,000 flowers are pollinated, which will get us about 250,000 seeds.
Mm. And that's all done by hand?
That's all done by hand, except the blender process. Everything else is done by hand. The seeds are collected by hand. They're planted by hand. They are evaluated by hand, which is basically my hands that touch pretty much all those seedlings at some point. Sometimes I come home, and honestly, my skin is not skin color. It's red because of the blood.
Right.
When they get big, I get a lot of scratches, and taking a shower in the morning, it's pretty painful. But I mean, again, you could put glove and everything, but I feel that it's a respect for the rose that I have to go gentle and touch them gentle, even though I want to kill them, the baby, because they're not selected, but I still do that gentle in some kind of a respect to them, you know. So by late February, mid-March, those little seeds that we planted right after Christmas time, they start to bloom already. So a lot of them, selection can be made without even seeing the bloom. That's something a lot of people won't realize, is we are not only selecting for the bloom. It's actually one of the last steps. We are selecting for vigor, for habits, for foliage, for disease resistance. And then when everything is right, we're hoping we'll have a good bloom on it. If it's the other way around, if it's a nice flower but everything else is wrong, it will be removed from the bed really quick in the selection.
Sure.
So
because if you don't have all that, you've got problems on the front end. So what good's a good bloom if it won't hold up on the shrub, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's why sometimes it is heartbreaking, because you see a really nice flower. You know, it's as far as flower goes, it is perfect. But, you know, let's say the plant is full of powdery mildew. So you have to make a call, and the call is pretty easy, is a no. So you take that seedling and you remove it from the seedling benches. But the peak time of selection in the greenhouse, it's mostly, like I say, about mid-March, April, and May, and still now going on in June, it's pretty active. So from the 250,000 seeds that are planted in the greenhouse, through the selection process, we will keep about 1,800 to 2,000 at the most. So that gives you a good idea how many I kill per year. So I just retired my old pair of clippers that I've been using for almost 10 years. The blade is just dull. There's like almost a quarter of an inch of the blade, of the metal, that's gone from being overused. And so on average, that pair, I probably have killed 100,000 seedlings per year, so we're talking a million seedlings so far. So it'll be part of the Rose Museum at Weeks. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but something like a little plate, a million rose kill, or something like that, something along that line.
That would be awesome.
But that's when the fun start is right after that. When you get those 1,800 to 2,000, they were one of a kind, and because again they came from a sexual process, which means every individual in that family are different, because it's like mom and the dad will have two kids, so the two kids are different unless they're identical twins, which is not very likely, but. All the seedlings in the rose population in the family will all be different. Some of them will be all red in one family, but it's because it happened that way. The two parents are just very strong genetic on the red side, but some parents give you all the colors. There's one parent we've been using for over 13 years, as far as I'm concerned, because I've been with Weeks for 13 years, and that one, I never can predict what he's going to give. He's giving all the color in the world, and which is great to use a parent, by the way, because you have all kind of seedling. When you have a family of 2,000 seedlings, they all red, like Omai came from a family that was all red. I could tell you at the end, I was tired of seeing red in that family because, you know, you want to see some color variation, but that cross of City of San Francisco cross with Crimson Bouquet, it was almost 100% red that came out of it, and we got Omai from it. But, you know, that's why it's nice to have some genetic variation in the seedling. But those go to the field after that, which is the real selection because they are garden rows. So I do care about how they perform in the greenhouse, but at the end, they're going to have to perform in the garden because that's where they're going to be used in the garden landscape area. So those seedlings are from one of a kind, like I say, because they're all individual, different. We're going to propagate 10 of each by budding going to the field. And then 2 years of selection in the field, they're going to go from 10 to 25 to 50 to 250. And then if everything goes well, again, you could count the year, you know, from 10 to 25 to 50. It's already 3 years, plus the 2 years they've been 1 year in the greenhouse of seedling, 1 year in pollination. Then we send them to the trial. We got some private trial ground in different climates around the United States. And we could narrow it down again to, at the time they get to the trial, we're talking about 15 that are left from the 200,000, 50,000 that we started with.
Wow.
So very few makes it. Every little detail counts. And if the petal is a little too pointy, out. If the petal curl back, out. There's so many criteria that we could discard a seedling. And most people will say, wow, that seedling is beautiful. Yeah, it's not too bad, you know, but we're just not looking for the not too bad one. We're looking for the best one, you know.
Oh, definitely. And I guess that trial program is really where the rubber meets the road as far as how well they're going to do across the country, right?
Yeah. I mean, some seedling are really good in, let's say, California, but they don't do well anywhere else. So then it's when the decision comes, are we going to introduce it or not for more of the hot, dry climates? And some seedling do well pretty much everywhere, you know? And so that's also part of the selection. We want to see which one is have some black spot resistance, which one has some rust resistance, downy mildew, powdery mildew. There's a lot in the selection process that is not known. Like I say, very few will make it. And it's pretty much like, you know, those seedling, the one that will be selected, it's like winning the gold medal. Very few people will win a gold medal at the Olympics. So the five or six that will make it at the end, they have been outstanding the whole process time, which is 10 years. Because even at the end, a couple of years ago, we had a seedling, we had 8,000 of it. So we thought it was really good. And at the end, it was just not good enough. And we end up mulching it.
True.
So I know for most gardener thinking about 8,000 rows planned that are turning to mulch and turning to compost to go back in the field, it's kind of a different concept than all the plan they have in their backyard. But, you know, that's why we make sure that we bring only the best one to the market, and we want to make sure they will be easy to grow and produce a lot of flowers so people can enjoy them without too much work. So that's pretty much the goal of the breeding, you know.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I guess, too, that speaks to that's why rose trials are so important, like the one that just concluded at Biltmore and Rose Hills and, you know, the ones that are held abroad. We need to see how they're actually going to perform in gardens all across the country. You know, our guests before you this morning, Mike and Angie Shute, you know, grow roses in Rhode Island. And, you know, a rose that will perform well in Rhode Island may not perform well in you know, South Alabama where I'm at. So those are important steps along the way. I think it's important that consumers know that, you know, from 250,000 plants, you know, it all comes down to one sometimes.
Yeah, and there are regional performance, so that's why something that's good for people, they could go at the a local botanical garden or garden, whatever, and look around what kind of rose they have there, and they could see which one performed the best, you know, and that gives them an idea of what to grow in their garden, because it's not true that every roses will grow well everywhere. I mean, some of them do, but most of them don't.
Sure. Now, you mentioned Oh My a few minutes ago. Now, I have three shrubs of Oh My that I planted mm-hmm. last year in my garden, and I can tell you that this rose, you know, that I want to thank you for that 10 years of research and rose trials, because this is a superior rose. It does awesome in our garden. It's been in flower all since early spring.
And one thing interesting about, again, I mentioned about the family of Oh My, they were all red. I think there were very few pinks in it, but they were mostly red. But maybe out of, I don't remember the exact seed count, but it was over 1,000. So let's say 1,200, I think it's in that range. I think we've selected probably a good 15, 20 plants, seedling from that family, and planted them outside in the field, like I say, which is one of the selection to trial for garden performance. And they all burn except one. What I mean by burn is when the petal edge turns black-brown, you know.
Wow.
And that came from Crimson Bouquet, because that one will burn outside in the sun, except one, which became Oh My, because that one, the color stay. If you look at Oh My, the red will not fade blue, or it will not burn, which is one thing. Also, at the end, when everything is perfect, you get the good plant, the good branching, the good vigor, the good foliage, good flower form. Well, you also want color stability, which means a yellow that fades yellow, at least with some yellow. It doesn't go all the way white. And some of the older red are going blue or pink. But if you look at Oh My, there's barely any difference between the fresh and the faded color, and it doesn't burn. So that's kind of how we make the selection. At the end, is like, yeah, it is, like you say, it is an improved seedling of what is already on the market. So
yeah, that's so true. I wanted to talk a little bit about fragrance in roses. You know, everyone, I know we had a garden party here a couple of weeks ago in our garden, and the first thing people did when they started to walk through the garden was they began to smell all the roses. And so I wanted to hear from, and I know our listeners want to hear from hybridizers and what your thoughts are about fragrance. And are you looking for fragrance, and are you trying to achieve fragrance in your crosses?
I think for, I'm going to say the last 4 or 5 years, focus has been so intense on disease resistance. You know, with all the shrub being very popular for landscape, and I have to admit that we were still looking for fragrance, but our focus was not directly on that. Not saying that's not important, but we crossbred a lot of shrub line with hybrid teas and to try to get the disease resistance of the shrub into the hybrid tea, but fragrance is not one that comes with disease resistance. A lot, actually, the gene for fragrance is probably very close to the gene on powdery mildew susceptibility, because a lot of the fragrant rose will be more susceptible. So that's when being focused on disease resistance, probably we had some good fragrant rose in the greenhouse, but we didn't select them because they were not up there on disease resistance. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, it seems like there's a gradual switch back to hybrid teas and Floribunda and Grandy. At least that's what I've shown last year in our sales. The shrub sales have went down a little bit, and the hybrid T cells are up. So the last 2 years, yes, we put back more hybrid T's and more fragrant hybrid T and more fragrant 4-abundant in the breeding line. Like I said, we never fully stopped trying to get the fragrance, but we just put it as a secondary focus a little bit. But now it is very important, and you're right about people putting their nose in the flower before they even almost even look at them, you know. So it is definitely part of a very important selection criteria.
Yeah. So I know your introduction of Sugar Moon was a, you know, a welcome surprise to have a quiet hybrid tea that is disease resistant and fragrant. It has a wonderful fragrance.
It, to me, in the catalog, what we call catalog fragrance, you know, there's always a little something when I mean catalog fragrance. You never say no fragrance at all. You know, you're going to say a slight fragrance, which in fact is probably no fragrance. But there's definitely some variety that are really powerful fragrance, and Sugar Moon is one of them. I mean, it's hard to stand after you smell it. You just almost fall on your knee because it's so powerful, you know.
Yeah.
To me, there's very few roses that can be claimed as being as fragrant as Sugar Moon, you know. A lot of them, like I say, they have something in the catalog. They'll say good fragrance or medium fragrance, but that one is powerful, you know. It won the best fragrance at Roseville last year, and I mean, it is a very strong fragrance.
Yeah, it's an awesome rose. We have one shrub of it in our garden, and it is beautiful. Some of the names of roses that come from wheats are always very interesting, and people ask me all the time, how in the world do they come up with the names of those roses? And, you know, when you look at a bloom of the Floribunda ketchup and mustard, you sort of think of that. So can you tell us a little bit about how you come up with the names for roses?
You know, and ketchup and mustard is a funny one because a lot of people are reacting on the name of that one. It is a fun name, and that's why you want to come up with something that people will remember, you know. If you call it sweet red and yellow, well, people will forget about the name, you know. If you call it ketchup and mustard, then it'll stick in people's head, and they will remember that one. So that's why when you're looking for a name, you need to find something catchy that also fits the variety well. You don't want a name to describe a pink, and you actually have a yellow rose. After working 10 years on developing the variety and getting ready to put in the commerce, finding the right name is almost the most important part right after trialing, because a bad name will kill a good rose, and a good name will sell a bad rose. So the naming process, there's so many different stories I could tell. But I'll just mention the story on ketchup and mustard. As a breeder, when you look at, like I say, so many seedlings in the field, you don't remember them all, you know. So sometimes we just use some color description like that to remember them. And that one, since its first bloom, even in the greenhouse, and I should have started saying that when we have 250,000 plant in little seedling in the greenhouse, you're going to remember very few of them. I mean, honestly, very few of them you're going to remember. But, I mean, Tom Kerut was with me in the greenhouse when we saw ketchup and mustard for the first time. And we remember exactly where it was in the greenhouse with all the other 100 or 200,000 seedlings around it. So it already made an impact on us. And so it was basically ketchup and mustard was a nickname that every time we're walking the field, oh, this is the ketchup and mustard, blah, 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 and then we describe the plant again. Because technically the number is S128-1 on ketchup and mustard. So that means it came from the family of 128, and -1 was the first seedling selected in that family. But, you know, instead of referring at it all the time at S28-1, and it also helps the salesman to remember it. So we say, we nicknamed it Ketchup and Mustard. So came the time to come up with an official name for the catalog, and we look at so many options. We have a folder with names that we've been accumulating for the last 15, 20 years, so many names that people proposed, suggested, and they're all listed. And we go through those lists, and we look in the dictionary, we look at, you know, anything that could inspire a name, we look at some music, some songs, title, or stuff like that. And we had other options on Ketchup and Mustard, but just nothing that was as obvious describing the variety as Ketchup and Mustard. So Tom and I, we just like sat down in the office at one point and say, well, let's just keep it Ketchup and Mustard, you know, so be it. And some people like the name and some people just don't totally hate the name, you know. It is a difficult process to find the right name. But in the case, I mean, I still feel good about the name personally. I've got some people saying it was not a good name for the role, and some people say it was an excellent name for the role. So it can never please everybody, but as far as describing the rose, it is red and yellow, so it's ketchup and mustard. And as far as people will remember it, yes, they will. So we achieved the goal of making an unknown seedling under S128-1 known as ketchup and mustard, and people will remember that name. So that's pretty much the process of naming a rose. If I could mention just maybe another story on sometime. Like Julia Child, we have, before the rose get introduced, we send sample plants to all the nurseries and garden centers that are week's customers, so they could preview the variety 1 year ahead of time. Julia Child was an All-American Rose Selection winner, so it could not have been named yet a year prior. So what happened is, actually, Julia Child was a customer at one of Week's Garden Center, and she showed up at the nursery, and she said, wow, what is that? And so we got contacted after that, and she would like to the rose name after her, and we just thought that was a great idea. So pretty much every rose has a story about how they get their name, you know. It's always quite interesting how we, you know, from a little seedling in the greenhouse, how they came from a number to the name, and each of them has a different story. So, but it is a complex process to get the right name to the right roses.
Yeah, that is so true. You know, and I think roses with names like ketchup and mustard, and you know the beautiful shrub rose that came out this year, Yabba Dabba Doo. You know, those appeal to children, and I could speak to that a little bit from personal experience. We had our shrubs of ketchup and mustard planted in our front yard, and one of our neighbor's daughters comes by the house, and they walk in our neighborhood, and she tells her mama, we've got to go by that house and see ketchup and mustard.
And that's right.
Yeah, so. You know, I think those types of interesting names and the look of the rose, you know, is very appealing to young people. And, you know, anything we can do to draw a child away from all of the distractions of this digital age we live in and get them out into the garden admiring roses, I think we've done something there. So it's a wonderful thing.
Well, there's a big gap in generation between the baby boomer and the next two generation coming as far as gardening. That's probably why one of the reasons the rose businesses are down, because the other generation are, like you said, there have not been, I mean, in general, not really be involved in gardening much. And if we could find a way with like funny names like that to get them involved in planting a rose bush or two and be successful with them, then maybe they'll get into more gardening and projects, and which is good for our business and it's good for them too. They get outside instead of watching TV and playing on computer. They could play outside a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. Now, our time is running short this morning, but I did want to talk to you just a moment about a very special rose that's being officially introduced next year, and that's the Coretta Scott King rose. And can you tell us a little bit about this rose?
Yes, actually, it's also one that I advertised that one, and it was I think it was a great honor for Mrs. King. When we work with the Coretta Scott King Foundation, they say that was this year was the 50th anniversary. I had a dream speech, and we just thought it would be nice to have a rose to commemorate Coretta Scott King's life. And a portion of the sale goes back to the Coretta Scott King Foundation. The rose itself, to me, is one that is almost all the time have those perfect bud shape. I have not seen that often on a rose that almost every stem comes with that, you know, classic high center bud with a good plant, vigorous, mostly upright, strong, again, strong vigor, beautiful foliage. A lot of the cream roses will have a pink blush. This one is more like a coral orange blush, which makes it, to me, very novel. Not so much strong fragrance, a little bit, I will say, but the good vigor, the bud shape, everything is pretty good on that rose.
Well, it certainly is a beautiful rose. You know, we planted a bed of those roses here at the Birmingham Botanical Garden in honor of Mrs. King and the 50 years forward project that's going on here to commemorate 50 years of the Civil Rights Movement here in Birmingham. And I was up there a couple of weeks ago, and they were in beautiful flush of bloom. And I'll tell you, it's wonderful that we can name roses that appeal to children and name roses that commemorate events and wonderful people in our lives. Christian, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your day just to spend some time with us here at Rose Chat. We appreciate what you do, and we hope that you'll come back and be with us again sometime.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. That was nice chatting with you.
It was great chatting with you. You have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.